Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. This is Keith Pannell, and today I'm on the road again, one of the things you know I enjoy doing. I'm over here at Midland College in Midland, Texas. There's a small research meeting for undergraduates, and there's some interesting faculty people here, and one of them is sitting opposite me right now in the studio. His name is Lou Densmore. He is the chairman of the Biological Sciences Department at Texas Tech University, and he's a big world authority on genomics and DNA analysis and mitochondrial analysis of crocodiles and alligators. You might ask yourself, why on earth would he be in Lubbock? And that's a good question, but Lou, welcome to Science Studio.
Well, thank you much, Keith. It's good to be here.
Now, tell me a little bit then. Why are you a scientist? Before we get into crocodiles,
sure.
Lubbock, Texas.
When I was probably 5 or 6 years old, like many kids of that age, I was just mesmerized by dinosaurs. I started off really probably wanting to be a paleontologist. And I think the reason I didn't is I don't think I have the patience. But
a paleontologist, someone who digs up fossils.
Digs up fossils, right. Yes.
And in fact, Lubbock's a good place for
it
that.
Is a very good place.
Dr. Chatterjee,
yes.
Yeah, right.
In fact, I've been out to their digs, and it's really remarkable.
Right.
Yeah, there's lots and lots of fossils. You can find fossils virtually every time you go.
Well, but that's not what you do.
But that's not what I do. So I always wanted to work with reptiles and amphibians, and I pretty much knew that.
You mean from a young age?
Yeah, reptile and amphibian. That's right. I loved them.
Your parents involved in this?
Interestingly enough, my mom is petrified of snakes. And I think actually that might have had some influence on me, is that I wasn't sure that they could be nearly as bad as she put them up to be. And so, you know, I just sort of gravitated, I think, toward that direction. And there were really two major forces in my life that ended up putting me where I am. And the first one, interestingly enough, was my eighth grade biology teacher at Ramstein Air Base when we were stationed in Germany. And his name was Travis Vernon Lee. And Mr. Lee was a man who really, really filled me with enthusiasm about doing biology. The next person is a gentleman named Wayne McAllister, who actually is now retired, but he taught at the Victoria College. And Wayne taught freshman biology, but the way that he taught it emphasized critical thinking. It emphasized the ability to answer questions in ways that other people might not be answering it, not necessarily based on rote memorization, but actually trying to figure out, based on sound scientific principles, what might actually be happening. He was very, very interesting, and I still do this to myself with my own students, is that he would, if you could come in and argue with good scientific logic for an answer that you put down, he would give you full credit, even though it was not the correct answer.
Gotcha.
And I teach molecular biology now myself, and I do exactly the same thing. And part of the reason is because molecular biology is changing so fast that you never know what's going to be the truth, or what was going to be gospel yesterday is not today.
Do you do the reverse? Somebody gets the right answer but hasn't got a clue how they got there?
I'm not nearly as comfortable with that. I want explanation.
Yeah.
Because explanation tells me that they critically thought.
Right.
I don't want to memorize them.
As with most scientists.
Yeah.
School teachers at one time or another became
really involved. Had an influence,
right.
Yep.
But why did you get into the biological sciences, and why into this crocodile alligator area?
Well, when I was at the University of Houston working on my master's, I actually worked on invertebrates, an isopod, and I was doing allozyme analysis, where you actually look at the proteins, and was trying to understand relationships and diversity within populations. The problem is that my major professor was not an expert in that, and I was almost having to do most of it by myself. And so I decided that what I needed to do was go to a place where I could actually work with experts in the field that were doing that. And that expert was Herb Dessauer, who was at the LSU Medical School.
Studying crocodiles at LSU Medical School.
That's amazing. We were a fifth wheel at a medical school,
okay,
I promise
right.
you, because we did very, very – we did a lot of lower vertebrate work. We didn't work with mice. We didn't work with humans. We didn't work with dogs. We worked with alligators and other lower vertebrates.
So as soon as you got to graduate school, I mean, that defined the rest of your career.
It did, yeah. Right. Once I got into Herb's lab at the LSU Med School, it was in biochemistry too, and I realized that I probably had to learn the techniques and the conceptual framework that underlied those, as well as how to do the technique, because right. my take is you can teach a chimp to do most techniques that we do in science. But the fact is, understanding what happens and being able to troubleshoot right. is a little more difficult.
And write the proposals, too.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's right.
Papers. Yeah. Okay, come on. Everybody wants to know. Tell me the big difference between crocodiles and alligators.
Well, if you... First
and is
of all,
it important that we should know?
I think it's probably reasonable that Americans should know, because we have both species. We have the American crocodile that's found primarily along the coast of Florida, and then the American alligator is distributed throughout the southeast. But the two animals differ pretty significantly. Most people will tell you that the alligator is a little more of a generalist. It'll eat more of almost anything. And, in fact, it typically has a very broad head and extremely strong jaws. The masseter muscle on the side of the head is capable, and it was the first one that was really tested. And at the time, it was by far the highest pounds per square inch. It was actually measured at over a ton per square inch in terms of ability to close the jaw.
It's like those stories about Rolls Royces. They say, what's the capacity of the engine? And
yeah.
The answer, sufficient.
Sufficient, right, exactly. And so alligators also, they have all of the teeth on the side of the jaw are covered by skin. So they literally fit into a socket. The teeth from the upper jaw fit into a socket in the lower jaw and reverse. In crocodiles, you'll always see at least that fourth tooth on the side exposed. Okay,
when the original creatures bite, then the skin just moves down.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and they open their jaw and they close it between. So it's really it doesn't impede them at all. Yeah.
Okay.
And typically, the American crocodile has a longer head. It's a little narrower, maybe not quite so robust as an alligator. And I think we. Even though crocs get very, very large, the American crocodile probably gets larger than any other croc in the world besides the saltwater crocodile from Australia. And I think there's legitimate claims of 19 or 20 footers that probably have existed in Panama.
So if James Bond has the criminal or the crook and drops him into a pond of crocodiles or alligators, does it make any difference?
I would prefer to be dropped among alligators, but it really doesn't make a big difference. The issue is how the animals respond to what they either perceive as prey or a potential danger. And crocodiles, in my opinion, are a little more aggressive most of the time. If you look at the average personality of a crocodile, they're going to be a little more aggressive. Alligators typically are, I won't say gentle by any imagination, but they generally give you a little more time before, you know, you just get jumped at, which you can find pretty quickly with a crocodile.
So they're similar, obviously, genetics, and we're going to come to that in a minute. But one of the sort of intriguing things from my point of view, do they interbreed?
Not alligators and crocodiles.
No,
they're members of distinct lineages.
Okay.
The closest relative to the American alligator is actually one of the very rarest of all crocodilian species, and that's the Chinese alligator. And it's in the Yangtze River Valley. And with the big dam going, or whatever it is doing over there, we don't know if they're going to finish it, but whatever's happening over there, it's destroying a fair amount of their habitat.
So then tell us, what is your research in these? I know it's to do with genomics and sort of understanding mitochondrial genetics, et cetera, but tell us.
What I'm interested in primarily is relationships. I'm interested in relationships between species, between large, deeper nodes, maybe between families. But I'm also interested in the population diversity we see within individual populations of animals. In other words, the genetic diversity, how different one animal is from another in the same population.
Okay.
And so it really depends what you're working on, what marker you use. Okay. And so there are markers that change very slowly relatively slowly.
You mean which part of the genome you look at?
Is that what you mean? Whether it's a protein coding gene, okay, or maybe in eukaryotes, of course, we have intervening sequences called introns. So sometimes an intron will evolve much, much faster than the region that actually codes for the protein adjacent to it, which is called an exon. But so we'll either look at an intron or we'll look at a region that is not under strong selection. Because if it's under strong selection, most of the time a change causes a change in the function,
right,
and therefore is negatively selected. So it doesn't happen very often.
So there are these big sequences which we don't necessarily understand.
Not necessarily the function of all,
no,
but for most of the, especially with the huge genomic upswing in genomic, total genomic sequences, we're getting a better and better handle on different regions of the genome and what many of those regions actually respond to or count as in terms of the function for the whole organism. And so because of that, understanding what genes code for is getting easier and easier.
I mean, you read these stories about, you know, my genomic pattern or makeup is not significantly different from that of some of the animals I'll see in the zoo. How close do crocodiles and alligators, A, come to each other and come to us?
Well, they're probably very close to one another.
Right.
And in fact, we're part of a international crocodile and genomics study that involves sequencing three major genomes. And I suspect that we're going to find a few differences between them in terms of gene organization or maybe how the genes are actually expressed and maybe subtly different functions, but very few.
And what about with us and a crocodile?
Virtually all vertebrates share a tremendous amount of,
right,
their genomes.
Yeah.
And because of that, again, you may see individual differences. You may see regions that because the gene may be expressed in a crocodile and is not expressed in as high, the protein may not be as important in humans,
yeah,
then you might expect the human protein to be under less selection. And so it could really vary a lot.
So you see a lot of similarity.
A lot of similarity, especially in organization,
right,
and probably great differences in gene expression.
Okay. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Llewellyn Lou Densmore. He's the chairman of Biological Sciences at Texas Tech. And we're talking about crocodiles, alligators, and a little bit about ourselves. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. Norbert, how often do we talk about how stressed out we are?
Hourly, which is terrible because chronic stress wears down the mind and body. It can cause mood disorders such as depression, which have enormous effects on the brain.
For example, the hippocampus, which is the brain's memory center, can shrink in people with a history of depression. And neurons, which are cells that allow a brain to receive and transmit signals, can't function normally. Now a new report leaves little doubt about the stress's toll on the brain.
This study shows chronic stress blocks a gene called Neuritin that normally protects the brain from mood disorders. Researchers experimented with rats, which also possess the Neuritin gene. For 35 days, the rats were isolated, given no food or play, and had their light and dark cycles flipped.
As expected, the rats showed signs of depression. They lost interest in food and sweetened drinks and didn't swim when placed in water. These rats had significantly lower Neuritin gene activity compared with rats in a control group.
While some of the depressed rats were given antidepressants to recover, others were injected with an engineered virus to spur Neuritin gene activity. These rats recovered just as well as those given antidepressants, which suggests Neuritin is effective at blocking stress and mood disorders.
To further prove Neuritin can protect the brain from depression, researchers blocked the Neuritin gene in healthy rats to see if they'd become depressed. They did.
Researchers can use the study to develop new therapies to treat mood disorders which plague 1 in 4 Americans.
For me, what's crystal clear is I need to lower the stress in my life. We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries are shaping the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Lou Densmore from Texas Tech University in Lubbock. And we're talking about crocodiles and alligators, and we now know a distinction. One's got a broader face than the other, or head, should I say. And, you know, genetically, they're very similar and maybe even quite similar to us. But what are you learning from this sort of a study that you think is imperative for us to know?
Well, first of all, crocodiles and alligators are really important parts of the ecosystems in which they live. They are often the very top predator, especially in those ecosystems where it's very wet or there's a lot of fresh water or whatever.
Neither of which apply to Lubbock, Texas.
No, that's true. Neither of which apply to Lubbock. And as I mentioned, my colleagues asked me why you would not be in Florida or why you wouldn't want to be on the coast studying alligators and crocodiles. And I say, because we have an airport, and I generally can get there pretty quickly. And besides, I like the dry climate in Lubbock. But I think that looking at understanding how populations diverge in these groups really does help us a great deal in terms of understanding where their positions are and how much they're liable to change, given things like global climate change and whether or not the populations are isolated. Because you can imagine that if the sea level changes a great deal, an animal that may have very, very free movement from one freshwater source to the next might have it cut off by intrusion of seawater.
That brings up an interesting point, though, because, I mean, one knows, well, maybe I'm wrong, that crocodiles and maybe alligators also have the capacity to survive in salt water and are, in fact, have been found, as I recall, in oceans, etc. So
it's primarily crocodiles, okay?
Right.
Alligators do not do well even in brackish water. It's got to be pretty fresh for them to do well. They can tolerate a little bit of salt, but by far the animals that are most tolerant of salts are some of the big crocodiles. There seems to be like one big crocodile in various continents, and if you look around the world, the saltwater crocodile is in Asia and even gets over to the Indian subcontinent, but throughout the islands of the Philippines, etc. The mugger crocodile is also a large one that's pretty much on the eastern coast of India. Then we have the Nile crocodile, which is in, obviously, the Nile River and throughout much of Africa. And in the New World, we primarily...
Hang on, though. It's in the Nile River. Can it get into the Mediterranean?
They probably can stay in brackish water enough that...
But not salt water.
Not just pure salt water.
Okay.
But they still have the ability to excrete salt through glands that are under their tongue. And the other of the four that really has that ability to a great deal is the New World crocodile, the American croc.
Okay, so they can survive for weeks, days, hours?
Yes, presumably it's a means of dispersal. And
what do you mean by dispersal?
By how it's a means of getting from one place to the other on a land, you know,
okay.
one terrestrial environment to the other.
So you have the aeroplane and they can swim.
Exactly.
Okay,
and they can swim for some distance too.
Right. What do they eat when they're out there? Anything?
Fish. When we were working in Belize on Morillette's crocodile, we found that a large proportion of the stomach contents in Morillette's crocs were fish, and believe it or not, snails, small crabs, and the occasional bird, or maybe the occasional small mammal. I think one of the real incredible misunderstandings that people have is that even in places like Africa, where we have the tremendous migrations of the wildebeest, and everyone has seen the National Geographic specials where the crocs are waiting in there for this one time a year. Well, most of the time during the year, they don't eat large mammals. They probably eat very, very small food.
Right.
And so it's a big difference when you see a big food coming.
Well, what eats a crocodile or an alligator?
Well, when they're young, lots and lots of herons and egrets. I've actually sat around.
How big is your young crocodile or
young
alligator?
So let me give you an example. For the alligator, typically you'll have a 3.5 to 4 foot tall mound of grass and various plant materials that are around the water. And the female will dig it up, and then she'll lay between 20 and 40 eggs in it. Typically, it takes about 60 days in Louisiana for them to hatch. And then when the babies hatch, they're probably about 7 inches long.
Okay. Right.
And before they hatch, they'll sit in the egg and they'll make a sound like... The female is actually able to pick that sound up even when the nest is covered up. And she will come back and dig the nest up, and often the babies are hatching, and there's many, many really outstanding films where you can see either a mother alligator or a mother crocodile taking them to the water or at least escorting them to the water. But I was actually watching an alligator nest that was right at about the time to hatch, and all around it were great blue herons.
Okay.
And they could hear it too, and they actually got a few babies.
I remember seeing movies, not that type, but the same concept of a snowy owl, you know, up there on a tree, and all you see is snow.
Exactly.
But it can hear the mouse that's running
through
and project where it's going to be.
Exactly.
I mean, nature is very good.
Well, and this is a really good source of protein for these birds, and all they have to do is be in the right place at the right time, and they've got supper.
Is there a threat? I mean, you talk about Florida. I mean, the Everglades would be alligators then.
Primarily alligators in the Everglades,
so,
yes.
So, I mean, I've remember someone talking about pythons being a bit of an issue in the Everglades. Talk about that.
That is a pretty serious issue. There's been tremendous amount of invasion of foreign species to Florida especially, and a lot of these invading species, at least for snakes, are Burmese pythons and other very large pythons. A Burmese python can easily get to close to 20 feet, and a 20-foot Burmese python can very easily take a 7 or 8 foot alligator.
How long have you seen this?
I've seen pictures of it several times. In fact, one of about a 13 or 14-foot Burmese python that tried to swallow about a 6.5-foot alligator that it had killed by suffocation, and it actually split the snake open because the animal had too much girth for it to swallow.
Right.
So, yeah.
But, I mean, so that this is a big issue.
It is actually a serious issue. It's probably a serious issue with other animals more than alligators simply because there's a lot more other animals out there that would be in the size range that these pythons could eat.
Yeah,
so mammals and things like that, you know.
It's easier to eat an appetizer than it is to
The main deal, especially when the main meal can eat you back.
You come from Lubbock, and so what is this place? I'm Amarillo, where they have this 72-ounce steak.
Oh, yes.
And if you can eat it, it's free, but they don't
in
tell
an hour.
You. Oh, I didn't know there was a time limit.
There's a time limit.
And there's the potatoes,
you
the
have
coleslaw,
to eat everything
the
with
salad,
it. That's right.
The whole rest of it.
I can't imagine even coming close to do that.
What have you learned? The most. Let's say you're talking to your grandmother here and say, Grandma, you know what I've done over my life? There's just a couple of things that are really, you know, interesting that I've been able to discover that other people recognize as being an important contribution.
Well, I think probably as far as crocodilian biology, my most important contribution has been the recognition. We were the first people to recognize that the true gharial, which is the long-snouted Indian form that lives in the Ganges River and a number of other places, is actually its closest relative is the false gharial, which even though that sounds like both of the names should be indicative of similar organisms, the false gharial, as far as its ecology, is a long-snouted crocodile. It eats anything. It's a generalist. It's really pretty brutal animal. The gharial, on the other hand, is a dedicated fish eater. Okay, and so because it's so different, it's so derived and specialized, its characteristics suggest that it would be very, very different, and we found that it wasn't.
And is that an environmental feature?
No, it is a function of their common ancestry.
No, but I mean the very fact that one likes fish and the other likes anything.
I think I think there are probably, you know, crocodilians are a very, very ancient group, probably going back.
Well, they are sort of a relic of a dinosaur.
They certainly shared the earth with dinosaurs at a number of times, probably originating in the Triassic about 225 million years ago. But anyway, over and over again, we've had certain crocodilian characteristics show up in different lineages, a long snout, a specialized fish-eating type of lifestyle. A broad snout is a more generalist. There have been some crocodilians that were 20 inches long as adults and walked on land totally. Okay, and then there have been not anymore. There have been some 40-foot long giants that literally probably were almost filter feeders in the sense that they ate small krill and things like that. So it's been a very, very diverse group, and we really see very few species that represent the total diversity that crocodilians have had in the past.
Do they get a bad rap in the public press? I mean, no one likes snakes, I gather, but I mean, I've not been exposed to crocodiles and alligators, but I don't think it would be my choice of animal.
It's interesting because, first of all, they're good to eat. And in places where we can actually set up sustainable conservation and management places, it would be an ideal food source for lots of people in the world.
Are there alligator farms?
There are alligator farms, and there are crocodile farms. And the way that it's really interesting is that these animals are endangered, okay, or protected everywhere they are. But the farmers in Bangladesh and many of the places in the Far East literally will take two different species of crocodile and hybridize them. And when they allow them to mate and form
mating.
Hybrids,
right.
Then it's no longer an endangered species.
So then they do interbreed.
Yes,
very frequently,
especially within the crocodiles.
And so the offspring is fair game.
The offspring is fine. And so
as a scientist, as a biologist, is that right?
Well, of course, I don't like to see any animals, and certainly not my study group, used for food. But the fact is, if people need food and you have a group that you are not normally found in the wild that you can artificially create and get a good protein source as well as good skins, then it's a win-win because the species in the wild presumably are protected to a much greater degree, and it's only the captive organisms
I'm with you.
That will be
this is
used.
Every now and again I teach a class on ethics in science, and you know, this concept of, well, there are certain things which are endangered, others which aren't, life becomes a lot cheaper. And I don't want to go there, but I mean, it just...
Oh, I understand what you're saying, and the fact that the hybrids, in some cases, have even more vigor, at least for a few generations, than either of the parents, makes them almost ideal for this kind of role.
Lou Densmore, Chairman, Biological Sciences, Texas Tech, in that arid, dry climate up there, a specialist in alligators and crocodiles and genomics. Great pleasure having you on Science Studio. Thank you so much.
Keith, it's been a real pleasure for me, and thank you very much. It was very nice to meet you and give a chance to talk.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And the more scientists that talk in the way you do, the more people out there begin to say, hey, now those scientists are pretty interesting people.
We get to travel to some of the best places in the world,
well,
too.
That's another issue which I don't want to go into. Anyway, and I'd like to thank Norma Martinez for putting the program together and you for listening out there. We'll be back next week with another program. Bye-bye.